From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark, here again with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, talking with you about what's new in healthy living, sharing some down-to-earth advice and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, call us now at 800-462-7413. And along with our calls, Zorba, some topics to talk about.
Yes, can't sleep, winter camping. Think about that. Winter camping in Wisconsin will help you sleep in a warm, comfortable bed. We'll talk about some of that research.
It'll help you sleep and you might die.
And I've done it, so we'll talk about that.
Okay.
Opioids and benzos, benzodiazepines, things such as lorazepam and alprazolam, whether or not they mix together, could it be toxic to you? We'll talk about that, the risks and benefits.
And our recipe.
Creamy carrot and leek soup. I happen to love leek soup. I happen to like carrots. I used to not like cooked carrots when I was a kid, but I now like cooked carrots in many forms. This is a delicious soup, especially good this time of year.
Got it. To the phones we go now, the Zorba, 800-462-7413 is our number. And our first caller joins in, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
I just had a question about fainting spells. I've experienced fainting in the past from getting shots or injections and having my blood drawn. But recently I had an annual pap smear done, just like a well woman's checkup, and I actually fainted after getting that done. Mm-hmm. And I've read on the internet that that can happen when you, I guess, experience pain or you are afraid, sort of like a mind over, like, matter kind of thing, I guess.
Oh, sure.
And I guess my question is there anything I can do about that short of just not going to the doctor?
That's right. Not go to the doctor. Gosh, I haven't gone to the doctor in 40 years because otherwise I would faint. You know, there are some things you can do. I want to talk a little bit about the pap smear. Tell me about that. The other we'll go over in a minute. So when did you faint?
That's why it concerned me, because it was a little different than the injections or the shots. It was actually maybe like 5 minutes after, and I was actually in a drive-thru. So that's why it bothered me so much. I could have been driving, I could have hurt someone.
So you were in a drive-thru restaurant. You left the doctor's office.
Well, I was actually in a drive-thru pool, and I was able to put it in park.
Okay.
And then I passed out. It was maybe like 30 seconds. I could tell because the person in front of me hadn't moved in the line. So it was maybe 30 seconds. And I felt, when I came to, I felt very hot and nauseous.
Yeah. I've got some great ideas for you. First of all, whenever you get your blood drawn, you tell the person who's drawing your blood, I'm a fainter. You have to have me lie down. Never have your blood drawn unless you're lying flat. You can't faint when you're lying flat. That's what it is. You can't faint. Yeah. You're lying flat. After they draw your blood, you tell them, I have to lie here for 5 minutes. And you put on a timer. Do you have a smartphone or a dumb phone? Okay, so you have a smartphone. Some of us don't have smartphones in this society. I'm looking
at
one right now.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that. He hasn't yet come to the 20th century, and we're in the 21st century. He's a Luddite. But anyway, take your smartphone, put it on for 5 minutes. Do not get up for 5 minutes. You will stop fainting. That's the most important thing, is the break, because what will happen when you sit up, first of all, when you sit up after 5 minutes, sit up slowly and think about it for like 10 seconds. You know, don't like jump up after 5 minutes, but sit up slowly, dangle your feet for like 5 seconds or 10 seconds, and then get up. And once you start to do that, after your blood is drawn, you will realize you're not going to faint because you can get over it. Now, for the rest of your life, you should always have your blood drawn lying down, period. Never have it drawn when you're sitting up. Tell them you're a fainter. Wait until a room is open. That's how you have the blood is drawn. Some of the phlebotomists will say, oh, you're okay. I can do it when you're sitting up. And your answer is, thank you so much. I want to lay down. Okay? because you will then break the cycle. The cycle is very important. This will impact on the fainting with the pap smear. In other words, there's a psychological component of fainting with the pap smear. So this will impact with that. Now, that's a vasovagal response, a little bit different in that, you know, it was stretching when they do the pap smear and put in the speculum. It's stretching of the vagina. So, you know, so the sensory input is a little bit different. But basically, it's the same psychological cycle response that you have. So what you want to do is the next time you go in for the pap smear, have your pap smear, lay down afterwards, and tell who's ever doing it, doctor, PA, nurse practitioner, hey, last time I came out, I fainted, so I may have to lay on the table for a few minutes. In which case, you put on your watch, 5 minutes, lay there for 5 minutes. When you're laying on a table for 5 minutes, it'll seem like an hour. But 5 minutes is an incredibly long time, and your body will then kind of restructure. And then have something to eat at the end of the pap smear. Have something that has calories in it, 100 calories. So it can be a drink that is a sugary drink. It can be a piece of candy. But get some glucose into your body right away. That will break the cycle.
Okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate
You're
it.
You're welcome. Good luck. Good
appreciate
luck.
The
Thank
call.
You.
Thank you very much. 800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. To a listener now, Zorba in Moscow, Idaho. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my question.
Sure. How can we help?
So my question is actually a spinoff from a recent episode of yours where you discussed armpit hair and body odor.
Yes.
And you commented that antiperspirant deodorant helps prevent odor. And that actually reminded me of a debate my husband and I have had over the past 16 years. Growing up, our moms believed that any ingested or absorbed aluminum would contribute to Alzheimer's. And as a result, we banned antiperspirant deodorant, baking powder, baking soda from our houses. And so my question is twofold. Where does this idea come from? Because it seems very prevalent amongst my friends and even younger generations. And is there any truth behind it?
Well, first of all, there is no truth, but I'll tell you where it comes from. It comes from some of the initial research that was done a long time ago, maybe 25 years ago, that looked at that aluminum. The hallmark of dementia and Alzheimer's are plaques and tangles, where kind of the network in your brain gets all screwed up, so the impulses just go the wrong way. And that's really not exactly what happens, but that's kind of what it looks like in some ways under the microscope. And these plaques and tangles are associated when they were doing some initial stains with aluminum. That's what it appeared to be. Now, aluminum is ubiquitous. It's in the environment. Aluminum is part, for instance, of aluminum hydroxide can be part of antacids. And so the thought is maybe aluminum cookware is causing an increase in Alzheimer's disease. Very prevalent, very important. Bunch of research went on because the question one is Alzheimer's coming from our cookware because we cook with aluminum all the time and maybe it's there. And then Teflon, by the way, got caught up in this whole thing because we cook with Teflon and maybe Teflon was an issue too.
That was huge.
Yeah, it was huge. And these were important questions to answer because the Romans were drinking out of copper vessels. The wealthy Romans were drinking out of copper vessels and getting copper poisoning back in the Roman Empire, which caused a form of delusion and dementia and was then blamed on the fall of the Roman Empire. I kind of think there were other things involved besides drinking out of copper, but that was kind of a question that came up. The research now shows it's not affected at all. It's nothing to do with it at all. So the research is there. Now, what's interesting about it, there are a few other things. First of all, baking soda does not have aluminum in it. I don't remember what's in baking powder. I think that might be an aluminum compound. But baking soda is sodium bicarbonate. There was no aluminum. So we've got mixed up, you know, in the whole thing. So I've got a couple questions. What did your mother cook in? Did she use cast iron?
Well, she kind of went back and forth because, you know, being conscientious, sometimes she would ban the whole aluminum. We did have one really old cast iron skillet, but she used, I think it was just stainless steel.
Stainless steel, mostly. Right, which would be stable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she also did not do the Teflon either for that same reason.
Right, see, so Teflon got caught. Now, how many kids were in the family?
There were three.
There were three kids. So, now, do you use antiperspirants now?
Well, so with this debate, because there's Alzheimer's in my family history, my husband, we don't use antiperspirant deodorant, sure. but we do use baking powder.
Yeah.
No experimental baking here. So that's kind of the compromise that we came up with.
And that is an okay compromise. So let's go to one question. Okay, so you've got Alzheimer's. Who has Alzheimer's in your family?
It's my husband's grandpa, his maternal grandfather, and I think that there's an extended relative or two. There's a fair amount of it.
Okay. So dementia, Alzheimer's, all dementia is not Alzheimer's. It's probably half of all dementia. The A diagnosis really kind of fits in. But when we actually do research on that, so what we want to do is reduce our risk. And by the way, there has been a drop in Alzheimer's disease on people who are not high school dropouts. The research
really?
High school dropouts, the Framingham Heart Study shows there's been, since 1980, there's been roughly a 25 to 30% drop in Alzheimer's among the Framingham cohort in Massachusetts that has affected everyone but high school dropouts. They have still the same rate of dementia as they did in the 1970s. We don't know why. But
so then what if he's a high school dropout but then went to college and became a math teacher?
That's the difference that's there. It's adaptation. He's a high school dropout that became a math teacher. And the reason probably is because blood pressure is under control, eating better, exercising, moderation in alcohol, no more than two drinks a day, no tobacco. All of these things fit in together, cardiovascular things that probably affect that. So I think you're doing the right thing. I don't think aluminum plays a role, but you know what? If we don't need to have antiperspirant. We can use other things to actually reduce perspiration, and baking soda certainly, or baking powder is certainly a way to go.
Okay.
So.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Take care.
I appreciate the call. Thank you very much.
Baking soda. I was getting mixed up, not baking powder. I think you'd bubble if you had baking powder.
Yeah, probably.
That's the stuff that makes you bubble.
800-462-7413. If you have a question for Zorba, what's this about winter capping to help us sleep?
Yeah. Well, first of all, let me tell you, I have done the freezeroo with my best buddy, Dan. Now, Dan, for the last at least 25 years, has said, let's camp out on the coldest week of the year in Wisconsin. So what would you think of that, Tom?
Well, I wouldn't be anxious to do it.
You wouldn't be anxious to do it. But I've done it. I've done it like five times with my daughter a number of times. And we would have a safe house. And one time it was 20 degrees below zero, but no wind. No wind. So it was 20 degrees below zero. And you know what the most difficult time in the middle of the night when you do that? You double sleeping bag. You're in all your clothes. Having to get up. And when nature calls, that 3 o'clock in the morning call when you go, I can just handle it, and in the end, you can't, and you have to get up, and it tends to wake you up. But nonetheless, I just want to say I've done it. So this was research that was published in the journal Current Biology, where they took five hardy volunteers 1 week in December in the Colorado Rockies, and they looked at their biological clocks, and they took them camping and basically had them sleep outside. Now, our ancestors, as you know, before artificial light came in, basically before electricity came in, which was only maybe 150 years ago. You know, before that, you had gas light, but gas light was expensive. But once, before electricity came in, when it was dark, pretty much you went to sleep because you didn't have anything to do.
Sure.
You know, well, you had sex. But other than sex to keep you awake, and, you know, that would only keep you awake for so long, people slept. And then they would often doze and sleep through the night. So they slept longer. They probably slept for, 10 hours or 10 and a half hours longer. But the question is whether or not this would make a difference. And he found a direct cause and effect that if you spent 4 to 5 days out in winter camping, you would then sleep longer in your regular bed for the next few weeks. In other words, you would then improve your, decrease your insomnia, improve your time in bed if you spent some time outside with your natural biological clock.
Why would that happen?
You mean, why would anyone do it?
No. Why would that affect?
Well, it may just change the circadian rhythm of the biological clock. The real issue is that artificial light affects our biological clock. We talk about seasonal affective disorder.
Yeah.
I talk about it all the time. I lose my energy around the first week of December, and I get it back when it's about the second week in January because the days are longer. We are affected by sunlight. We're affected by sleep with that. And it might be the cold weather also resets our biological clocks. Why? I don't have any idea. I don't know why. But I would recommend, do you have trouble sleeping?
No.
Okay.
Here's my guess on that.
You don't have
is
trouble?
After sleeping out in the cold for, what, three or four nights or so?
Five nights.
You're so happy to be inside in warm bedroom that you say, I'm going to really sleep.
That's right.
And that lasts for a long time.
You know something? Maybe that's what it is. You're so happy to be inside in warm weather that's why it resets your biological clock. Hey, you know something? Strike up one for Tom Clark, researcher at
Tom Clark on your health. 800-462-7413 is our number. That's 800-462-7413. Before the break, Zorba, we've learned over the years that our listeners don't always agree with you, so let's fire up another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. The following email came to us from a listener named Mike in Dallas, Texas. He writes, Doc, you might want to rethink your recommendation of an LED light box for seasonal affective disorder. I saw a news segment recently announcing there is research showing that the short wavelength violet, blue, magenta components of light from screens damages eyes. As white LEDs have a strong output of these components, they could prove to be deleterious to vision, especially as they are more intense than screens. Maybe a blue blocking, filtering film could be applied to light boxes to make them safer. There are several articles I found on the topic. Here's one to read. And Zorba, you took a look at that article?
I did take a look at that article. Yeah, I did take a look at it. Thank you for sending me the article.
Yeah.
I always like articles that people send me. Well, this reminds me of back in the 50s when my mom said, don't sit too close to the TV. It has radiation and you'll die or you'll go blind. Mm-hmm. It reminds me of when my mom would say, don't read in bed at night with the light. You'll go blind. And also when she said, if the light's too low, don't read in low light.
Yeah.
You'll go blind. And she was big on blindness, you know. She never had any trouble with macular degeneration or cataracts, but she thought that all these things would make you blind. But when we look at light, I'll tell you what the most deleterious light is. And the most deleterious light is when you're in Colorado, in the mountains, in the Rockies, in Denver, at 5,000 feet above sea level. The light is more dangerous. Yeah. You're more likely to get macular degeneration and cataracts. And if you live at 8,000 feet, you're more likely to get that, not from the blue light, but the fact that you have more radiation that basically comes, because we see the visual light spectrum, but there are other things in the electromagnetic radiation that definitely affect our eyes. I don't think there's any credible research that shows that LED lights are bad. That's what I think. There's no credible research. Whenever new stuff comes out, there's always the ooh danger factor, and I say the voodoo. Now, some of it may be real. Don't get me wrong, mm-hmm. but the issue is once we have a change in technology, there's always a fear involved. Fear is okay. I think it's good because we have to question technology. Some of the technology is good. Some of it is bad, but I don't think there's any evidence at this point that LED lights really are very different, for instance, than incandescent lights and fluorescent lights. When fluorescent lights came in, they had some of the same issues. We do know that all light that affects the eye that has energy, including LED lights, helps with seasonal affective disorder. I don't believe that a screen necessarily is going to make any difference because I don't think there's any reason to put a screen on because there's no evidence about it. So choose whether or not you're going to use it, but I think screen, nope.
Got it. Do you think Zorba missed something? feel free to show him the light.
Oh, I love it.
Just post on our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
Hang around. We have the recipe coming up. Lots more of your calls, of course, later on our medical myth buster. More research, too, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That number again is 800-462-7413. You'll find a line open for you right now. But Zorba, before our next call, creamy carrot and leek soup.
That's right. Now, do you like carrots or not?
Yeah, I like carrots, okay.
Okay. So in other words, you'd put it in the range of 5 to 10 in the 5 or 6 range.
Well, a little higher. I like carrots.
Okay. 7?
Maybe 7. Maybe, eight.
Seven,
yeah.
Okay, how about leeks?
I don't even know if I like leeks or not.
They're an onion. They're like a green onion. They're an onion. I mean, that's what they are.
I like the onions, onion okay, yeah.
7, 8?
Yeah, I like the same, yeah.
Yeah, it's about the same. So this really is, and you like cream, do you like cream soups? Do you like the texture of cream soups?
Sure, that's fine.
7 or 8?
Yeah. I guess, yeah.
So this is 7 or 8. You didn't seem excited about the recipe, but the recipe is really good. Leek soup has a wonderful, full, rich flavor. And carrots, we don't do enough with carrots. And mm-hmm. I was kind of thinking about this the other day because I was reading the Wall Street Journal, New York Times. I look at recipes, look at a lot of recipes online. They're talking about carrots, braising carrots, roasting carrots, different ways of cooking carrots. As mm-hmm. a kid, I hated cooked carrots. I didn't like them at all. Fresh carrots were fine. But as an adult, I find I really like carrots. They're sweet. And we should do more with carrots. And I like onions. And this is a recipe that utilizes it. Very simple, very easy, very good.
My mouth is watering.
Very good. So start out with 2 pounds of carrots.
2 pounds of carrots.
That's right. 3 large leeks.
3 large leeks.
You know what the leeks look like. They look like giant green onions. You've seen them in the...
Yeah, I guess. Yeah,
you've seen them. Yeah. You guess you've seen them. That's as close as we get. Tom's guessed he's seen them. So 3 garlic cloves minced.
3 garlic cloves minced.
4 tablespoonfuls of butter.
4 big tea butter.
1 tablespoon of fresh thyme leaves. If you can get them, you can use 1 teaspoon of dried. Fresh is better, but 1 teaspoon of dried will be okay, too.
Okay. A big tea, fresh thyme leaves.
1 tablespoon of lemon zest.
Big tea, lemon
now,
zest.
Now, I recommend if you don't have a good zester or you don't like your zester, go buy one. I mean, they last forever. And basically, on little grater things, you know, whatever those things are that you grate stuff, there's always a little zester on those little square things with the grater. But they're not really very good. And so getting an individual zester is worth the $5 or $10 commitment that you make.
Okay.
8 cups of a vegetable stock or a chicken stock. Now, I am an omnivore. I always prefer a chicken stock over a vegetable stock. I have not really found a veggie stock that knocks it out of the park as much as a chicken stock. But choose your stock.
Mm-hmm.
Eight cups.
8 cups of it.
I use a cup of wine. So white wine like a Sauvignon. You could also use my go-to 1 cup of white wine is often a vermouth. Vermouth is very good. I usually get an inexpensive vermouth because I like it. It stays. It doesn't go back. I get like a Gallo or something like that. Not an expensive vermouth. I've used expensive and inexpensive, and I can't tell the difference.
Cup of white wine.
I can't tell the difference when it's not a martini. I'm talking about doing that. Martinis are, I don't know much about martinis. This is a non-martini
okay.
recipe.
Don't put
moving on.
In here. Yeah.
Moving on. Yeah. 1/2 cup of sour cream or cream fraiche. And salt and pepper.
S&P.
Okay. So trim the carrots, chop them into 1/2-inch chunks. Trim the root ends off the leeks, cut the white section into quarters. Make sure you wash them because leeks often have dirt in the middle of them, so wash them. Slice across into small 1/2-inch pieces. Save the greens later because you may use them for homemade stocks. You may decide to use them. You can't use them in salads. They're too tough. Place the chopped leeks in a colander. Rinse them thoroughly, like I say, because they're often sandy or gritty. Now, in a large pot over medium heat, heat the butter, carrots, leeks, garlic. Saute under gentle heat for 10 minutes, not too high, stirring very, very regularly. Then add the thyme, lemon zest, stock, wine, teaspoon of salt, a little pepper to taste. Cover, bring to a boil, stir it and cover it. Simmer for like 20, 25 minutes until the soup looks murky and the carrots are soft. Got to get those carrots nice and soft. Then ladle the soup into a nice blender. You might have to do this in two batches, or I use an immersion. I often just use an immersion blender and do it right in the pot. You know what those things are? I don't know if you've ever seen them, Tom, but they look like the inside of a blender, and you put it right in the pot.
Oh, no, I haven't.
Well, you ought to buy one for Mona for all the cooking she does. It'll be a great birthday gift.
It'll collect dust.
You can label it into a high-powered blender, or you can use an immersion blender like I do. Place the list. Make sure that you vent it for steam. If you use the immersion, it's much easier. But you want to puree it until smooth. Once it's smooth, add the sour cream to the blender, move it around again and puree it again, or the creme fraiche, and pour the batches into the soft pot, warm it up, and serve it. It's really
this
good.
This sounds pretty good. If I'd like a copy of this.
Well, recipe. You could use your smartphone, go to our website or your computer, zorbapastor.org. That's zorbapastor.org. Or, of course, you can find us through Facebook, because that's where the source of all knowledge comes from in this day and age. That's Facebook.
Let's take another call now at 800-462-7413. A listener with us in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about my daughter's vitiligo.
And vitiligo is whitening of the skin.
Correct.
Whitening of the skin. Okay.
Do you know anything that you can treat that?
So how old is your daughter?
She's in 35.
She's 35. And when did she start developing vitiligo, and where is it on her body?
16 years old. She had it on her eyes, and elbow, and her knee, and on her feet.
And on her feet also. And what has she done for it? Has she seen a dermatologist for this?
Yes, we did. Twice. And the first time, I didn't know there's a specialist for this. And then I took her again. I let her go to the doctor again, and they said they got nothing to do with it.
Right, right. So she went there. Did they give her any creams at all to help her vitiligo?
No, sir.
Does she have any scarring at all? Does she scar easily?
I don't think so.
No. So, you know, obviously this is very disturbing. And vitiligo is very disturbing to people, especially when it affects their face. It affects you more if you're non-Caucasian, if you're dark-skinned, because, you know, the difference is on there. There are a couple of issues. The problem with vitiligo is it's very difficult to treat. In other words, there's some vitiligo is caused by certain infections, fungal infections and other infections. And so we treat those when those occur. Others types of vitiligo occur after strep infections, once again, because it can affect the skin and then the skin tans differently. And beyond that, it's not easy. And so for many people, the treatment is actually to go and get psychological help to be able to deal with the problem, because it's a problem, especially when it's on the face. Going to a vitiligo specialist to rule out all those things that can cause vitiligo, that's the number one thing to do. And unfortunately, I don't have anything beyond that, that can really help your daughter. How is she adjusting to it?
She's fine with it. But the thing is, I don't like to see it. I'm not comfortable with it because I don't know.
So she is okay with it, but you're disturbed by it. Is that it? So that's very important to know. Very important to know, because she's the one who has the problem. So it's very, very good that she has adjusted to it and accepted that this is me. That's really what it is. And counseling for that can be very important, because many of us have disabilities and have problems, and adjusting to that disability and problem is so very, very important. Have you thought about getting counseling for this yourself?
No, sir, no.
I would highly recommend it, and I'll tell you why. There's something called cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT. C as in Charlie, cognitive, B as in behavioral, and T as in therapy. And cognitive behavioral therapy is an excellent therapy. It's usually 5 to 10 sessions, and it gives you a way to take a problem, look at it, and adjust to it. These are problems usually that people have that they have no control over. You have no control over this. You don't have any control over your kids, that's for sure.
Yes.
And your daughter is doing well because she's had therapy. But this is something where I would highly recommend you talk to your healthcare provider and have them recommend somebody who does CBT therapy in your area. And once again, it's usually 5 to 10 visits where you can then look at it, see the problem, and adapt to the problem. And that's in your best interest. That would be my recommendation.
Thank you so much. But the thing is, can you recommend me to any specialist that can help her, like laser? I see on the iPad there's a laser.
Well,
is that good?
The best thing to do is, if you want to get a second opinion, go to a university dermatology department. Because you know, in a university dermatology department, they've done research and they'll be the most up to date. So if you're going to get a second opinion, I like a medical school for a second opinion. If I go, there's nothing we can do, go to a medical school, dermatology department, you're likely to get the best information from that. So I would recommend you do that. That will help you also to get that opinion. But the other thing I would recommend is CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, because you have to adjust to your daughter's malady. It sounds like she has gone through a major adjustment herself. So please call us back and let us know what happens.
Okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Sorba.
You're welcome. I hope that we've helped. It's a difficult problem, and I hope that we've helped you with this.
Yeah, thank you so much for the call. And Zorba, thank you for that really good advice.
Oh, thanks, Tom.
800-462-7413. 800-462-7413. Before the break, Zorba, we love it when our listeners post on our Facebook page, so we scooped up a few of these questions and comments and would like to share them with you today in a segment we call Facebook Feedback.
Facebook Feedback.
Are you ready, Zorba?
I'm totally ready. I was ready to do some sort of like a dance move like Jimmy Fallon, but, you know, I'm no Jimmy Fallon. That's what my wife says every day. You are no Jimmy Fallon.
Really? Every day?
No, never.
First up, Elizabeth in Gotham, Wisconsin asks, Zorba, we hear lots of information on fake olive oils. Can you please explain how to tell if an olive oil is fake or real?
Well, that's a really good question, because you can't always tell. You can't necessarily tell by the taste, because half the olive oil may be regular oil. Buy from a reputable dealer. That's what you do. Go to a place. Buy from a reputable dealer where you know exactly what the label says. Go to a Trader Joe's or your local grocery store. Ask them to make sure there's a lot of fake olive oil out there, with a little olive oil and a lot of canola oil.
Next, Ronald in Jacksonville, Florida asks, what is the name of those socks you mentioned for people whose feet hurt?
Well, I happen to like the FIT socks. FIT. Google it. Look at it online. It's kind of a compression stocking for walking, and I find it's very, very useful. A lot of people like it because it puts pressure on your feet, and for whatever reason, that pressure makes your feet feel better.
Mm-hmm. Now, a question from a rather cultured listener named Deb in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Dr. Zorba, what is your favorite brand of yogurt?
Oh, my favorite brand of yogurt is that brand of yogurt that happens to be in the refrigerator that I bought last. And that's my favorite brand of yogurt. I like all different brands of yogurt. I'm not as partial to Greek yogurt. I'm more partial to, believe it or not, full-fat yogurt that I buy at Trader Joe's that is a vanilla yogurt that I think hits it out of the park. It's not low-fat. It's full-fat, and I have less of it so I can keep my fat calories calories down. It is delicious.
Okay, Zorba, a listener named Beverly in Colorado has a question about joints. She asks,
what kind of joints? The joints you smoke or the joints in your body?
That's very good.
You like that. I'm a child of the 60s.
Why does Midwest humidity create inflamed joint muscles?
Believe it or not, people in Florida, California, Nevada, Hawaii, the Arctic, and Bali all have arthritis. And believe it or not, it's not as if joint pain bothers you no matter where you are. I think when it's cold and it's outside and it's moist, we just kind of creep up psychologically and our joints bother us. But believe me, if you move to Arizona, you're still going to have arthritis.
And finally, Zorba, Amy in Tampa, Florida offered us this nice comment. You and Tom keep me sane on the weekends. I'm missing living in Madison so much, and you guys keep me connected and so well informed now that I'm getting to that age. Thank you.
Sweet.
Let's keep the flood of Facebook comments coming, and you can always send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
More calls to come, as well as another interesting topic at our Medical Mythbuster 2. Here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That number again is 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, problems mixing opioids and alcohol.
Well, opioids and alcohol, and also some tranquilizers, things called benzos, benzodiazepines such as lorazepam and alprazolam can also produce problems. So here's the issue. We know that we're in the middle of an opioid epidemic of deaths. We know that from overdose. So we know that especially young people who then get opioids either on the street or from grandma or grandpa's cabinet or their parents' cabinet or directly through their doctor are dying at an alarmingly high rate. Mm. And it's because we, and I'm included in the we, have prescribed opioids for chronic pain and we overprescribe them. And so we're pulling back. You know, we as doctors have learned our lessons on how to use it, and now we have to pull back and pull back as a society. But mixing opioids and alcohol turns out to be an issue, and it's an issue that we can't test for. So, for instance, in our office, when we prescribe opioids now on a regular basis, periodically, we do drug tests to look at things and look at how whether or not people are taking other drugs such as cocaine or a marijuana, medical marijuana, for example, because mm-hmm. we want to be able to counsel them on that. But we can't test for alcohol unless they come in the office drunk. Well, it turns out alcohol and opioids together can cause respiratory depression. And more people are ending up in the emergency room, especially elderly people in the ages of like 65 or 70 or 75 that don't realize they're taking an opioid, hydrocodone or oxycodone, mm-hmm. you know, for their pain, well, and then they're having two drinks at night.
Do doctors usually say, hey, you shouldn't drink if you're taking these?
Well, you go to your doctor. Do you hear everything a doctor says? No, of course not.
Of course.
That's right. Of course, right. Every breath. And you go to the pharmacist and it says, don't drink any alcohol. And you say, okay, but, you know, in Wisconsin, the Packers are playing and you decide you're going to have a beer. Well, one beer might be too much. We don't really know. Depends on the person and what their meds are. Mm-hmm. Two beers might be too much. Three beers, of course, are going to be too much. And so I think it's important for the public, for everyone to realize that if you're on an opioid, you shouldn't drink. Or if you are going to drink, then you have to discuss with your health care provider how much can you drink, or your pharmacist, is one drink safe? So is any alcohol with any opioids safe? It's a good question. Depends on your medical problem, your condition, the other medications you're on. Remember, the side effects of medications are additive. So Yeah, people don't listen to everything I have to say. Of course not. But I think this is important to get out. Benzos, which are basically used for anxieties, and alcohol and opioids do not mix well together, especially if you're older. And if you're younger, they don't mix well together because often you take too much of it. So it's important to realize it. Talk to your pharmacist. Talk to your doctor. Stay healthy.
Back to the phones we go, Zorba, at 800-462-7413. Welcoming a listener now in West Lafayette, Indiana. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
I'm wondering if there are any spices or herbs that actually have a therapeutic value. I have a list of some that you're supposed to use every day, including cinnamon. The other ones that were on my list, and I don't know where I got this list, but it was you were supposed to use thyme, marjoram, oregano, and Italian spice, and cloves. Do they have any therapeutic value?
A few years ago, I read an excellent book called The Taste of Conquest, and it talked about the spice trade in Venice, the spice trade in Lisbon, and the spice trade in Amsterdam, and the importance of spices and what they were doing. And spices, a lot of times, were not just for food. And not just, you know, to show wealth, because spices used to be very, very expensive. I mean, they're dirt cheap now compared to what they used to be. The Spice Islands that the Dutch had is because they had basically a monopoly on cinnamon. And cinnamon we use in a whole bunch of things. Now, Ayurvedic medicine, which is medicine that is traditional Indian medicine, uses a lot of turmeric. And a lot of Ayurvedic physicians recommend that you have turmeric every day in one form or another. That's a major component in curry. Thyme, like you say, and cinnamon have all been used in the past. You know, I think from a wellness point of view, there's not a lot of science on it. That just means that science is mute, doesn't have an answer to this. So I think if you want to take spices, you certainly can do that. And if it makes you feel better, I kind of would continue with it. From science point of view, I don't know anything about it. It doesn't prevent cancer. I don't think there's evidence that it prevents heart disease. But it might make you feel better. You know, it's very interesting. We as medical practitioners know how to deal with disease. Somebody has depression, we can help. We recommend therapy or antidepressants. But when it comes to a point of view of how do you stay healthy, well, we know exercise is good, and we say eat a better diet, a Mediterranean diet. But what do we do beyond that? We don't know much because we don't have a lot of research on what produces optimal health. And maybe spices help produce that. We just don't have a good way of studying it, so I can't give you the best answer.
Thank you.
You're welcome. How old are you, by the way?
94.
So at 94, you obviously have some secrets. What is yeah. your secret to good health?
Well, eat a good breakfast and try to exercise.
And you don't smoke, right?
No.
And how much how much alcohol do you drink?
I wish I could drink more.
You wish you could drink more? Move to Wisconsin. When you cross the border, you get a six-pack every day. It's part of
interesting. And by the way, on this list of herbs that I have, it says if you have ginger, check with your doctor before eating ginger.
Oh, you can have all the ginger you want to. I love ginger tea. You know what? You just checked with your doctor, and I say it's okay. At 94, eat all the ginger you want.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you. We really appreciate
it. We need her list on the internet. That's what we need.
800-462-7413. Zorba, time again now for our medical Mythbuster segment. Today's question comes from a listener, Daryl, in Veblen, South Dakota. He writes, "Hi, Zorba. Growing up, both my mom and dad would tell me that if you eat bananas, mosquitoes will be more attracted to you. Something about the odor, I guess. They also said that garlic can help to repel them, as if they're vampires or something." You always shoot from the hip, Zorba, so tell me, were my parents full of it?
Yes, 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 yes. Well, we in Wisconsin in the summertime are very proactive when it comes to mosquitoes because, frankly, we hate them.
Yeah.
We hate them. And they hatch. And when I go outside, the mosquitoes are attracted to my wife. That's the best way to keep mosquitoes away from me because who knows why. We've never quite figured it out. She never puts
on
perfume.
They are more attracted to some people than other people.
They are definitely attracted to her. She'll go outside and she'll be swarmed with mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. And they don't go around me at all. When they bite me, I don't respond. And when they bite her, she develops great big lumps. Now, I eat more bananas than she eats, so I don't think the bananas are part of it. And when it comes to garlic, we both eat about the same amount of garlic, and I frankly don't think they'll be repelled by garlic like vampires. So I think your parents were probably mistaken.
Have a myth for Zorba, or maybe something you heard has been bugging you? Just post on our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413 is our number. And Zorba, our next caller is in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
I have a question. I think I know what the answer is, but I need some reassurance, I guess. I just turned 70. I'm in fairly good health. Mm-hmm. I have an old ankle injury, and I am still dealing with it. So I'll just tell you what happened, and maybe you can give me some advice. Okay. 15 years ago, I was in a hurry, and I was running into a mall to pick up my husband's Christmas gift, mm-hmm. and I slipped on a piece of ice outside the mall and broke my ankle.
Now, I have to tell you something. I'm going to make a little aside here. My wife had a similar experience when she was buying her husband, i.e. me, Christmas gift. She slipped on ice in the mall, fell down, and broke her shoulder. So basically, what have we learned from this? Do not do last-minute Christmas gifts slipping in the mall.
Well, this shows true love.
Yes, it does. Yes, like that O. Henry story with the comb, the famous
right.
O. Henry story.
Right.
So good. So this was about 15 years ago.
Yes, it was about 15 mm-hmm. years ago, and it turned out that I broke the tibia, the mm-hmm. lower tibia, mm-hmm. and then some smaller ankle bones that were on the top of my foot.
You did a good job,
and,
didn't you?
I did. And they said it, and I waited 6 weeks, mm-hmm. and then they checked it and decided they should have done something else. So they inserted a long screw through the tibia with a claw mm-hmm. on the end of it.
Okay.
It looks on the x-rays really sinister.
Yes, it is. Yes, they do look sinister. So they did an internal, what we call an internal fixation because things were not stable.
Right. I've been since told that they probably should have removed it after mm-hmm. it was healed, but it's still in there. And now,
so who told you that it should be removed?
An orthopedic surgeon.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Who I've been consulting because mm-hmm. I get really sharp pain if I turn my foot a certain way or just for no reason at all that I can think of, all of a sudden it will hurt really bad, kind mm-hmm. of in the back of my calf, but also on top of my foot where that claw is.
Okay.
So sometimes I can't walk on it for a few days. Sometimes it just goes away in a half hour or so, mm-hmm. but it affects me enough that we really like to travel and do a lot of walking when we travel. So I've been getting steroid injections for the last couple of years just to keep the pain away.
Oh, so it's significant pain. It's not an ache.
It is.
It's a pain, and it sounds like it's disabled.
No, it's a pain that keeps me off my feet.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what did the orthopedic surgeon recommend now?
Taking the hardware out mm-hmm. because I know I can't get the steroid injections continually
right.
for the rest of my life,
right.
and I want to be able to use my ankle. So she said that she can just back it out, mm-hmm. unscrewing it. The claw will open up and release, and she said it's a fairly easy thing to do, she assured me. My question is, would you do this? Would you have it removed after 15 years?
If it were disabling, which it is, and I couldn't do uh-huh. what I wanted to do, mm-hmm. Which it is, then I would go for it. I would definitely do it. I would do it because I would say, look, I can't do the things I want to do. I can't engage in the sport I want to do. In your case, it's walking and doing that. You know you can't do steroid shots all the time. You run a risk, of course. The hardware is there. The bones have healed, and the hardware was an important part, but the hardware is in the bones. So when they remove it, it's going to be painful because there are going to be micro fractures in the bone when they actually remove the claw and the hardware because the bone, the calcium is healed around it. If this is a common procedure, and removal of hardware is a common procedure that people often do if they have symptoms. So I've got hardware in my ankle from an ankle fracture, and I have no symptoms at all. I'm never going to have it removed. I mean, I would never do that because it would not make any sense. But if one piece of the hardware, the screw, were to start to bother me, I would have the screw backed out and I would have it removed. So once again, it's based on symptoms. And if you can't do what you want to do, then the risk is I'm going to have this pain for the rest of my life and I can't do stuff. And that's not what you the way you want to live your life. So I think if it improves quality of life, hey, there's a risk. What's the risk? Have somebody who does this all the time, and I would do it. I don't have any doubts that I would do that.
Okay.
Does that help?
Yeah. Before you go, a tip for you and for Penny Pastor. Next Christmas, shop online.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Hope we were helpful.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. 800-462-7413. And before we sign off, Zorba, we always love it when our listeners chime in with helpful information. The following note came to us on our Facebook page from a listener named Jim in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. He's referring to a caller who may have had a sensitivity to caramel coloring. Here's what Jim wrote. Dr. Zorba, while actual caramel is made from sugar, caramel color is not. It's a petroleum product.
Oh.
The manufacturers were able to get the regulators to let them say caramel color on food labels because, I suppose, it's not as alarming as saying 10W40 Pennzoil.
Coloring allowed on there. I love it. I love it. Yeah. Well, I guess he's right. I stand corrected. If that's the case. Now, I have not done a Google search to see whether or not that's the case. However, part of me says I'm not surprised. And the other part of me says, really? This is a petroleum product? And I don't know which part is correct, but leave it for what it is. Our public radio listeners will do their own research.
Absolutely. Have a helpful tip for Zorba. Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org or, of course, through Facebook.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen. Our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
For more Zorba Pastor on Your Health, including episodes, recipes, and tips mentioned on the program, visit ZorbaPastor.org. This year, we're celebrating the show's 25th anniversary, and we want to hear from you. How has Zorba helped you out? What have you learned from the show over the years? Leave us a message at 800-462-7413.